Welcome to AI Snacks with Romy and Robbie, an AI literacy podcast translating AI and robotic technologies from difficult to easy to understand. I'm your host, Anastasia. I spent 34 years working for Fortune 500 companies and startups. And for those watching on YouTube, this is my British short hair and an AI influencer. And he is the protagonist of Romy and Robbie AI book series for the whole family. Today, we're discussing AI in medicine and healthcare. When Eric Topol released Deep Medicine in 2019, the world of healthcare was at crossroads. Hospitals were drowning in data, doctors were burning out, and patients often felt more like entities in an electronic record than human beings. And Topol's vision was radical, but yet deeply human. Artificial intelligence, in his eyes, could help medicine go deep again, deep into data, deep into diagnosis, and most importantly, deep into human empathy. So Topol was describing a world where machines would take over pattern recognition, paperwork, and predictions, freeing clinicians to rediscover the art of care. And he was promising the world where AI could give us back our most precious clinical resource, and this is time. Now let's fast forward to today. I am having a wonderful guest in my studio, and this is Dr. Marshall Runge. He's a cardiologist, he's a researcher, and he's CEO of Michigan Medicine. He wrote a fabulous book, The Great Healthcare Disruption, and he takes the readers inside the revolution already remaking American healthcare. He talks about AI-driven diagnostics and genetic therapies, and he mentions the rise of Google and Amazon as unexpected healthcare players. So he's describing the world to be reinvented with help of new technologies, and he is talking about AI in mental health. So let's invite him into the studio and learn about application of AI and machine learning in the world of medicine and healthcare. And by the way, even if he works in the United States, his discoveries and his insights are applicable to other countries. Let's open the studio. Marshall, welcome to my studio and congratulations on your new book.
Oh, thank you very much. It's great to be on your program.
So, Marshall, you are a cardiologist, you are a researcher, you are a medical professional, and you are CEO of a medical facility in the United States, and you published this hugely interesting book emphasizing the role and application of AI and robotics in modern healthcare industry. You are focusing on the United States, but in my eyes, what you write is applicable to the global systems of healthcare. And what made you actually write this book at this stage of your career?
Well, I've been interested for the last 5 to 10 years. We're looking at, maybe tsunami is too big a word, but we're looking at an opportunity to really change healthcare. And I think healthcare throughout the world in the United States has lots of strengths, but it has lots of weaknesses. And in my role as CEO of Michigan Medicine, a big multi-hospital healthcare system, we're constantly thinking, well, how can we do our jobs better? And when AI started, it started with a whisper, but it was a roar so quickly, faster than anything I've ever experienced in my life. And so I thought that we need to figure out how can we best use AI. There are thousands of entrepreneurs wanting to get into healthcare. Some will be really positive for healthcare and for people. Others may not be so positive.
Absolutely. And all healthcare systems are different across the globe. It depends on regulation. And not every single healthcare system is allowed to raise prices, for example, for care or for new medicine, for drugs. In your book, I came across quite an inspiring story, and it came from the Hong Kong University. And you talk about this low-cost mRNA machine powered by artificial intelligence. And And it can provide similar images to those very expensive machines. And the team was capable to deploy machine learning and design something less pricey. So this is a true help for those hospitals and practitioners who can't clearly invest thousands and thousands of dollars or whatever the local currency is. In your research, what were the most interesting and unexpected stories of utilization of AI and machine learning?
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples. So one is in the area of development of new pharmaceuticals, new drugs. And we know in research and healthcare, there are quite a lot of diseases, some of them cancer, some of them others, that we just don't have a good medicine for. And they fall into the category of being called undruggable. It's impossible to find a drug that works for those. And for many years, I was on the board of Eli Lilly, which is a big pharmaceutical company. And they struggled with this. They tried for several different kinds of lung cancer. They were trying to find just the right drug, and they couldn't quite find it. And when AI came along, and they understood the power of it, they were able to take all of their medications that they developed, that they know many, many properties of the numbers that get to market. That's probably 1,000th of the numbers of medicines they developed. And so they put that into an AI algorithm. Then they put in characteristics of the cancer and the key molecules in that cancer strain that have been undruggable. And a number of other components to get more and more technical. The funniest part, in a way, was that when they did this experiment, they utilized the entire Midwest Google server farm for a day and a half. So nobody else could do anything on using those Google servers. That's how much computing power it took. But at the end of the day, they came out with five new medicines. Chemical structures that no one had ever seen before. They estimate it would have taken 100 medicinal chemists 10 years to come up with that set of medications. They came up with it in a few days. And as it's turned out, and they were looking for drugs that had an efficacy, had an effect, but also were safe. And what they found were, of the five molecules, a couple of them fit that perfectly in an area that had need. There are people dying of this kind of lung cancer, and I think they'll be transformational. And so the lesson I learned from that is that this is not something the human mind can get your whole mind around. Millions of molecules, millions of properties, millions of potential targets, and targets you want to avoid so the medicine doesn't have side effects. So that was, to me, was a very powerful message. Now to go to...
I absolutely love this story. And, you know, it shows actually this human to machine collaboration, because it were a very precise task. So humans could really ask this very strategic question, what they wanted to achieve. And then they deployed the best capabilities of the machine. And kudos to them. We will return to this example because I'm very curious about utilization of synthetic data in clinical research and drug development. But please give me more examples first.
All right. So I'll give you two other examples. One is on a purely operational standpoint. So I don't know how it is when you seek an appointment with your doctor or need to be in the hospital or feel ill. It's frequently difficult to access healthcare, whether it's in the United States, in Europe, in Canada, many places, because there's just an overwhelming need. And what we had been working on and what everyone's been working on is to try to make our healthcare providers a little more efficient, and maybe that can open up some spaces. And what AI has been able to do is to increase efficiency in that flow in amazing ways. So I'll give you one example of that. This was done in a hospital in Texas, in a suburb of Houston called Cypress. It's the Methodist Healthcare System. They used AI to look at operating room efficiency. And so the AI analyzed every single surgeon that operated in those operating rooms. And they saw that, for example, if it was me, I'm not a surgeon, but if it was me, once I put in that final stitch, the patient's ready to go to the recovery room. And so they'll be there in 15 minutes. If it's another surgeon, it might be 45 minutes. So it made that predictable, which for families and loved ones who are waiting for their family member to get out of surgery, that was great, because otherwise, if you've been in that situation, you go to the desk and the person at the desk says, well, I don't know, they're working on it, we'll get back to you. But some precision, and so that has turned out to be a great satisfier for those waiting for their loved ones. But on the efficiency side, what it can predict is that I finished my case and we need housekeeping there in 15 minutes to clean the room. And when somebody else is finishing their case, housekeeping needs to be there in 45 minutes, not in 15 minutes. And generally the way it works is that a case is finished, there's some milling around, the patient goes to the recovery room, and there's at least an hour lost between most cases. This has reduced that dramatically. And so in that hospital, they were able to do between 15 and 20% more surgeries per day. And so when you think about that, so let's say the operating room is not one that has very, very long, long cases, but has shorter cases, they might do 5 or 6 in a day. Now they can do 7 or 8 in a day. And that enables people to have their surgery on a much more predictable and rapid manner. And the same kinds of things are being done in emergency room settings in the United States. The emergency room has become almost a primary care provider for people. They go there whether they're having a heart attack or whether they have an injury or whether they have a mild flu-like syndrome. And AI is, I think, is very effective when used properly in trying to help triage those patients into those that they need to be seen immediately. And we do a pretty good job of that. And then the others, though, are there alternatives? And AI can, just in the same way it can help with scheduling, they can say, well, Marshall, you're here. I know you don't feel well, but we're going to have the doctor see you briefly, but probably you can go home and make an appointment with your physician. In fact, the AI machine, will make that appointment for you tomorrow. And so that process might take hours otherwise. So none of these things are perfect, but they are so encouraging in terms of how we utilize our healthcare resources.
No, this is a fantastic example. I wish it could be absolutely scalable across the hospitals and across the countries, because from the process perspective, it's standard. It could be applied in Germany or in France or in the United States. And it actually gives back clinicians the most important resource they might have, and this is time. Yeah?
I'll give you one other example that's coming along. And this is based on, people talk a lot about, well, will AI replace doctors and nurses and other healthcare providers? And personally, I don't think it will. And I give you a long litany of reasons that if you're interested in that. But the example I want to give you is how I think it can be enormously beneficial. So this came from an experiment. Well, not even an experiment. New approach put in place for the University of Michigan, that's where I work, for undergraduate students, that when they come to college, if they wish, and almost all of them wish to have this, they can have an AI assistant. And what does this AI assistant do? Well, the AI assistant, if they miss the class or they need to get the class notes or the slides, it can get that information for them like that. If they need to get more information, it can get more information for them. It's something they don't understand properly. If it's a mathematical problem and they're not understanding that, it can give them 20 other examples until they work through that and understand it. But the most important thing it does is it learns. So you've commented previously about the machine learning aspect of it. So it learns, maybe I learn best listening. Maybe somebody else learns best reading. Maybe somebody else learns best answering test questions, sample questions. So it learns and it really tutors in a way that is not around just a rote tutoring. It's how can it help each student individually perform their best. And so that same model is now being used in healthcare for physicians. A physician's assistant is there is a job called a physician's assistant that does different things, but a physician's assistant or a nursing assistant. And in the places that that has been done, it has an enormously positive response from all care providers.
This is a fantastic story, actually, and it shows how it goes deep into the education system, but helps those professionals in maintenance jobs as well, because, you know, circumstances changes. We have more and more technologies deploy, and how can the human mind cope with all those changes? So here, AI, of course, can help tremendously. You know, I'm wondering, just listening to you, you know, years ago, Google discovered from the data set of human eye scans that the machine could identify the gender of a human being, though for a doctor, it did not really matter. So an eye was an eye, whether it was a female eye or a male eye. But then there were questions whether maybe this gender factor contributed to the condition. And sometimes we don't know, maybe we will learn in years to come. Did you see something strange or something unexpected when you looked across all kind of deployments of AI in medicine? What was there? And we have never paid attention to the factor, but maybe AI spotted it.
Yes, I wish I could give you a specific example. I can't. But what I can tell you is that I've seen modeling. So the most interesting modeling I saw was around the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States. And so there were a very small number of people who actually had COVID-19 months before in the United States, months before it was realized, this first sort of larger grouping. And I think that's pretty emblematic of what AI can do. So from the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, which I think very highly of, they have these models. And once there's enough influenza in Seattle, they say, well, that's the new form of influenza. Or once there's an outbreak of measles in Texas, and there's been that recently, it has to get to a certain size before it can really be analyzed in the older models. With AI, what it can do is, while scanning electronic medical records across the United States, and this is not done completely now, but it's on its way, it can say, well, this is interesting. There's a respiratory disease, and there's two people in New York City, but there's also a person in Chicago and one in San Francisco. What could be similar to it? And when people, and this is in retrospect, when they've analyzed that, there's strong evidence that the COVID-19 pandemic could have been understood. It really only became understood in about late February or March of 2020, but it could have been understood by September of 2019. And had that been the case, and had we been able to utilize some of the tools that were developed around COVID-19, for example, rapid development of vaccines and use of novel therapies, we would have had a big head start on the COVID pandemic. And so that is an example. But I think, as you know, data, people say this, and I always kind of rebuffed it, but I think data is king, but or queen, or is the master. And but you have to have a way to analyze it. And most of what, for example, that example, I mean, maybe you could emulate that with 100 analysts, or maybe not. So I think that is yet another example of the power of AI.
I just wonder, listening to you, so this case of the global pandemic, and probably there are cases of something what is going on, major flu outbreaks, something not as big as a pandemic, but still tremendously important. Do you see cooperations between countries and healthcare systems where AI is getting deployed to compare data, to compare insights, and derive some conclusions?
I certainly hope so. I think there's a great opportunity for that, and there's certainly people that are interested. However, I will say, as a caution, people are competitive. And companies are competitive, and universities are competitive. And so right now, everybody's trying to develop their own systems And there is some reluctance to have as much communication as possible. Some of the electronic medical records in the United States really do not foster interoperability, meaning that my medical record and your medical record can be looked at in the same way. So I think that's more of a human and political issue than it is an AI issue. But I feel confident we're going to get there. One of the EHR companies, Oracle, has now developed a method to be able to take data from any electronic medical record and put it into a format that is understandable and can be analyzed. Now, not everybody accepts that so far, but it's very powerful.
That's tremendously powerful because data, medical data, of course, is siloed. And I mean, you can unleash the power of data only if you bring it into something readable for AIs and for the human eyes. And in this context, I'm just very curious about the future because, for example, I'm not in big support of this, but this is what is going on. So HR professionals are coming to me and reporting that all the HR records are currently being designed in the formats which are readable to machine learning systems and AIs. So if you apply with companies, most probably your application will be seen by a robot first, by a machine, and then it might then be filtered out and go to a human. And I'm just curious, so what is the path forward for medical data?
Yeah, I think that is truly one of the big cautions. So you gave that example of gender identity by an ophthalmologic exam. But there, these large data sets are connected. And I worry a lot about PHI, protected health information. And a lot of people worry about that. They don't want their PHI out there or having anybody analyze it because that's supposed to be among your most private information. But when you think about it, if Google, Amazon, you name it, and medical records are all using AI and that AI communicates in some way, we may be looking at having to develop new guardrails around PHI because otherwise, and there have been, I'll call them experiments done in this way, where my gender, my age, my healthcare problems are available in an electronic medical record. On the other hand, Amazon knows exactly what I order. Google knows what I look up to try to understand my illness. And I do worry that those things could come together and they could say, oh, we know who that is. That's Marshall. He's, in fact, at this time of day, he's probably sitting at his desk talking to Anastasia.
I bet they know, but you know, for me, I'm a huge believer in the necessity to invest into developing of small data and small data technologies, not just those ginormous data sets. And I'm a huge believer in decentralized data markets. And I don't believe that we can come to a really precision medicine and personalized medicine without having somewhere a human record, but it should be stored accordingly. It can't be in some central system. Maybe it will have to do with edge computing. Maybe it will have to do with some applications on blockchain. I do not know the path, but I think we need to consider all of those possibilities to actually make this vision alive and triangle, let's say, diet data, data of your movements, maybe your health record, how do you travel, and genetics, right? Then we can come to a truly probably personalized view on a human being. Without it might be very difficult. But I would like to come to something what you were describing before. So new drugs. And I'm aware about a bunch of companies developing new medicines with help of AI, and they utilize synthetic data when they need to grow the data set for further purposes. How do you think about the problem of synthetics? I mean, you really, it's not really an augmentation. You increase the volume, but you add something which is already there. You just duplicate or triplicate it. How do you think about it?
I think very positively about it. So I think it's a powerful direction in several different ways. For drug discovery itself, I think as we think about drug testing, and you know that's important to all of us. Does the drug work? Is it safe? And I'm a cardiologist, and some of the studies in cardiology have utilized 20, 30,000 patients. I take several years to complete, and the cost of those in today's dollars would probably be $5 billion just to do that study. And I'll give you a specific example. A very, very commonly used drug in heart disease are statins. These are these drugs that lower cholesterol. And the big statin trial showed that if you have had a prior heart attack, or even if you haven't, but you have risk factors, that will lessen your risk of dying of a heart attack. But when those are now reanalyzed and looked at closely, of those 30,000 patients, it may be 5,000 who had a big effect and 25,000 who didn't really have any effect except for maybe having some of the side effects. So if you think about how do we get drugs to market quickly, I think that AI can help pick a much smaller population based on what we today know about genetics and we know about other phenotypes and other characteristics of people in healthcare with illnesses. So imagine being able to, instead of having to study 10,000 patients, if you could study 1,000 patients in a very targeted way, I think that could get drugs to market more quickly. In the United States and worldwide, cost of medications is a big, big issue. And the newer medications, particularly the genetic medications that are used for rare diseases, are enormously expensive. And so there are lots of things that go into that. And it does cost a lot of money to make those medicines. But once they're made, they could be tested much more quickly, and they either work or they don't work. I think that could help be part of the equation that lowers drug costs.
That's interesting. And I have another question in connection with drug development. And this question is coming from very young readers of my AI series for the whole family, which I called Romy and Robbie. So Romy is a cat, Robbie is the robot. I was doing a public reading last week in a school, and the sixth graders, so they knew that you will come on my podcast, they wanted to know whether AI might reduce the necessity to test medicine on animals. And they were aware that those tests are reduced, but we still use mice and sometimes some primates. So how can we think about animal testing in the age of AI?
Well, those are smart sixth graders you've been talking to.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was an IB school.
Oh, so yes, I think so. So what you're talking, at first I thought maybe you're talking about veterinary medications, but you're talking about use of animals in testing drugs for human use. So that's another area of rapid development in terms of experimental models. And people have been critical of without data, cellular models instead of using an animal. I think as these are becoming more sophisticated, these non-living animal models, and they can be analyzed in vast numbers now with AI. I think that we're going to learn a lot more. There are many startup companies that are testing non-living organism, well, cells are living, not non-animal organisms for testing of medications. And as you probably know, you can, not in a test tube exactly, but in that setting, you can grow a small liver. You can grow a small brain. So these are not things that would function as a liver or function as a brain, but could be a great asset to drug testing. So I think that it will really have a very positive impact in that area. At the University of Michigan, we use so many mice. It's ridiculous. And that's true for many universities because you have a different mouse model for every different potential disease. And I think there's a much more efficient way to do it. Now, I wish I could tell you exactly what that is. I don't know exactly what it is, but I think the potential is there.
Well, but we are still in very early days in applying machine learning and AI in healthcare and medicine. And I truly appreciated part of your book when you were discussing mental health and AI. And there are very different takes on the subject. You were quoting a study from Stanford where students were actually delighted to utilize AI, and they reported that talking to a chatbot reduced their anxiety. So it was a very positive thing. But there are many studies where researchers are showing that there's harm to humans if maybe this chatbot is not built with great care and insights. So how do you view this whole era of applications of AI in mental health and research of human psychology?
I think that's a really tough area. Now, there's some, we'll say easy parts of it, but there's some parts that are quite interesting, which is analysis of voice patterns in people who may have any of a number of behavioral health or mental health illnesses. And it's not what you'd think. It's not a person saying, I feel really depressed, or, you know, I'm really anxious. It has to do with variations in their voice patterns and subtle variations that I think humans might not pick up. And so there now are a number of studies showing that that may be a helpful early screening. So, you know, I think more of that kind of approach, more of that kind of analysis can be very powerful. Where I do think there's a big risk area now is this one-to-one interaction between a person and a chatbot. And there, you know, it's on the one hand, it's anecdotal. On the other hand, it's very concerning that people will, particularly people who are isolated, may feel that that chatbot is their best friend and their best confidant. And that has led people to make horrendous decisions. And one of the features that I don't know how to correct, but is present in AI is AI is not empathetic, but it says, these chatbots say what they think will be helpful to you. And so it appears that they understand and they're very empathetic. And really what they're doing is sort of based on what you say, giving you a response that, however the programming works, and that's way, way beyond me, the bot is programmed to think that it's making progress. And so there have been a number of, I don't mean to say this with a smile, there have been a number of instances of people committing suicide because they felt they were led down that road. Another highly publicized case was of a person who had really no known mental health problems and got working with, but was isolated. And the AI bot really almost convinced him that he could fly. And said, well, the way to test that is you stand up on a building, you jump off, and you'll see you can fly. And of course, he couldn't fly. And at some point, he or a human friend said, wait a minute, that's not right. But it's not hard to understand that people can develop that kind of tie because many people do feel isolated. And an AI bot, this is a terrible comparison, but I love dogs. We don't have a dog currently. But you come home to your dog and they're happy to see you and no matter what. And you know, as long as you don't mistreat your animal. And it's kind of that way with a AI bot, chatbot, that they're always happy to see you. They're not going to be critical of you and say, well, you're stupid. You're working too hard. You're not doing this, doing that. So I think that's in my area, my thoughts in healthcare in general. That is the area. There are many limitations where AI can make mistakes, but I think that's the one that is most dangerous today. And it's too bad because, and I think it'll get better, but in the United States, mental health resources are among the most scarce of any kind of healthcare.
That's a very interesting because China is huge on applying AI in psychiatry and psychology. And this is because they have one psychologist per 100,000 humans. And I mean, how can you actually just perform in such a system where you lack humans to step in? So I totally understand the search of those mental health applications, but this is why I work in AI literacy, because I explain to everyone who wants to listen, those models don't even understand they use language, because they use tokens, and a token might be a unit of an audio signal. It might be a unit of code. So they don't really know. They talk to you, and we use human language to describe what they do, but all they do is this mimicking. And I think that once humans understand that, with all the power, they rethink their expectations towards AIs and robots, taking current architecture. So I really hope that we will apply better research and fund this research to deliver better architectures, which don't exist those days. So all those transformers and neural networks. But, come to the closure of this podcast. So all your experience and life experience, how do you think, how would you advise a university how to bring AI literacy to medical students, to those who just start at the university and those who might be on their PhD tracks? So how do you think about it?
Well, Anastasia, you've hit on one of our most difficult problems. And because AI has tremendous potential, the young people who are coming into healthcare, medicine, or other areas of healthcare, they will be early adopters, and because that's how they grew up. And for those, we have to put some guardrails around it. And I'll tell you what I think one of the guardrails is. For people of my age, senior physicians, they may just reject it. And so we have to say, no, this. And to give you one example of this, we tested that there are these two or three different companies have very powerful programs called ambient AI. And so they listen to a conversation like you and I, but could be listening to a patient and a physician. And they capture that entire conversation, the AI does. It doesn't just give a transcript. It gives a really high quality medical note. Now the physician has to read it. And we were trying to decide, are we going to implement this broadly? Many of our senior physicians said, no way. And what they found was, once they tried it, that it saved them hours a day from writing medical notes, because they'd get a pretty good medical note instantly. And so at the end of the day, instead of trying to write medical notes on 20 or 25 patients, they were written, and they just needed to proof them. And so I give that as an example of bringing people in who might not otherwise be brought in. On the other side of the equation, with the young people, for example, one thing that we're trying to help our medical students with is understanding that AI can be great in triage, but you shouldn't depend on it for diagnosis. So if I'm lying on a table and I'm saying I have severe pain in my abdominal area, that can mean any of 50 things. And it partly depends on my pain threshold. But it depends on, is it all over? Is it right there where my appendix is? There's a particular spot in your right lower abdomen, which is characteristic, but not diagnostic. But AI can't do that examination. But it can tell a physician, well, here's what's going on with this patient. They've had fever. They have abdominal pain. They have X, Y, and Z. Now see them. So you go in armed with that information. So we're trying to figure out where is that balance. And I would love to say that we have it all figured out. We don't. But I think many of us are working on that.
I just believe we must be open and learn and learn and learn. And your example, it reminded me on a book I really enjoyed as a child, and that was Jerome, Three Men and a Board. So, you know, when he goes to the library and starts reading medical encyclopedia, diagnosing every single disease out there with one exception, which was the fever after giving birth, because he is a man. And I am just wondering whether at some point in time we will face patients walking in with an exact diagnosis because they talked to Google or Amazon of all the places. Yeah.
I don't know if you saw the movie. It's been some years now, called Excelsium, which was a futuristic movie where with Matt Damon and Jodie Foster, where there was this kind of little planet outside the Earth and you could go. But what caught my attention about that, even at the time, was they had this machine that looked like a CAT scanner. You could go through that and it would say cancer identified, then cancer corrected. That's what everybody wants, but we're not quite there yet.
I need to watch this movie. And by the way, on this very podcast, we have a series which I record with my co-host, professor of creative writing and science fiction and movies, Ray Mulstock. She teaches at the University at Albany in New York. And we're discussing portrayals of AI in movies and books to kind of, you know, deep dive those human expectations around those digital technologies. Marshall, I can't thank you enough for this. I will put into the notes to this podcast all the information about your book. Once again, congratulations. It's quite a comprehensive book to understand what is going on in the U.S. Healthcare system and in AIs across the globe applied to medical research and healthcare. Thank you so much. How can we follow on your work besides the book? Where can we find you?
First of all, let me tell you that I learned quite a lot from our conversation. So thank you. In terms of getting in touch with me, there's a website, which is Dr. Marshall, spelled the way my first name is, Runge.com. And so that's a website that has information about the book, places that I've spoken. And one exciting thing that I'm very excited about is I am working now to develop a online course about healthcare that's based largely around the great healthcare disruption, but we'll also be thinking about additional challenges that we'll face. I hope to get that launched within about 6 months, so it's not quite ready yet, but I've been working with a team here that does at the University of Michigan and does these online courses, and there'll be different levels. One level will be very low cost. It's basically like listening to podcasts and lectures. But there'll be two other levels where people, if they're interested, can get very engaged, and I'll personally get engaged in working with them. So
this will be something for my daughter, because she's 16, but she wants to go into medicine.
Oh, good for her.
Absolutely. So, Marshall, once again, thank you so much. And we will follow up even after this recording. Your podcast will drop on November 18th. Now I'm closing the studio, and I will see my listeners in a week. Thank you. This concluded another episode of AI Snacks with Romy and Robbie, an AI literacy podcast. For those watching on YouTube, you can spot that Romy, my British shortcut, has returned to the studio to say his goodbyes. We will see you next week, and this show is supported by listeners like you. So please order a copy of Romy, Robbie, and the Secrets of Sleep, the first volume of the Romy and Robbie AI series, on Amazon or on the book website. You see all the information in this show's notes. I'm very grateful for your time, and I'm very grateful that you decided to learn about AI and machine learning. Thank you, and I see you next week.